You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, do you enjoy listening to Kick-Ass News? Well, then become a part of what I'm doing here and help support the show by going to patreon.com/kickassnews and making a donation. Your encouragement and support is always appreciated. And now, enjoy the podcast. I think that's about as much of the Simpsons intro as I can legally hum without getting sued by Fox and/or composer Danny Elfman, but I always say, it's not copyright infringement if it's done with love, right? And no one, and I mean no one, loves the Simpsons more than yours truly. That little yellow family has been a weirdly significant part of my life for the past 27 years. I can still remember going to school the day after the very first episode aired in 1989, yikes, and The Simpsons were all that we kids could talk about that day. And later on, in college, my roommates and I had a nightly routine that revolved around watching The Simpsons reruns at 5 o'clock, then racing to the cafeteria, scarfing down our food, and running back to the dorm to catch the second episode of The Simpsons a half hour later. Come to think of it, that may have been the only exercise I got all 4 years. Even today, I still consider The Simpsons appointment television and an essential part of my Sunday evening ritual. For my money, it's still the best damn show on television and probably the greatest TV show of all time. And you know, Time magazine agrees. In 1999, they named The Simpsons the 20th century's best television series. And in that same issue, Time included Bart Simpson in their list of the 100 most influential people of the century, the only fictional character to make the Time 100 list. In 2008, The Simpsons placed first on Entertainment Weekly's list of the top 100 shows of the past 25 years and named Homer Simpson the greatest character of the last 20 years. TV Guide named Simpsons as the greatest TV cartoon of all time and the 10th greatest show of all time. This is to say nothing of all the awards heaped on The Simpsons, including 31 Primetime Emmys, 30 Annie Awards, and a Peabody Award. It's by far the longest-running primetime series in television history, now entering its 28th season. Just to give you a reference point, no other television show has ever lasted longer than 20 seasons. But the impact of The Simpsons goes far beyond mere accolades and records. No entertainment has influenced our society over the past 3 decades the way The Simpsons has, both reflecting and influencing our culture with every single episode. Darren Franich of Entertainment Weekly has said, quote, "The Simpsons turned hyper-referentiality into an art form, regularly packing in throwaway references to high and low culture right from the start." Indeed, Simpsons references have become such a part of our conversation that we almost forget their origins. And of course, let's not forget all of those signature catchphrases like,
"Heidly ho, neighborinos!
Yoink! Ay, caramba!
Excellent."
Several of the words that were first heard on The Simpsons have even been legitimized with inclusion in the Webster's and Oxford dictionaries, such as
"don't"
and
"meh."
And of course,
"it's a perfectly cromulent word."
As Mark Lieberman, director of the Linguistics Data Consortium, once put it, The Simpsons has apparently taken over from Shakespeare and the Bible as our culture's greatest source of idioms, catchphrases, and sundry other textual allusions. The Simpsons has been no less influential within the entertainment industry itself, After all, would the Fox network still be around today if it hadn't had a runaway hit like The Simpsons to establish the fledgling network in the early years? And as the first primetime animated series since The Flintstones aired 30 years prior, The Simpsons both paved the way and set the standard for adult animated shows that would follow, including South Park, Futurama, King of the Hill, and of course Family Guy, which frankly we all know is a blatant ripoff of The Simpsons. It's also been credited with influencing live-action series like Malcolm in the Middle and The Office, and The Simpsons writers' room has been a famous breeding ground for some of the funniest talents in Hollywood, including Conan O'Brien. Today I'll talk with the man who acts as part impresario, den mother, and drill sergeant over that writer's room, Al Jean. He's won 8 Emmy Awards, a Peabody, and a Cable Ace Award, remember those? And he was a writer on The Simpsons from day one. He's now overseen the show as head writer, executive producer, and showrunner on The Simpsons for most of its 28 seasons. Al Jean still remembers watching the first finished episode titled Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire and thinking to himself it was the greatest project he had ever been involved with and he wanted to work on The Simpsons for the rest of his career. Even though he was only 27 at the time, he had racked up an impressive list of credits. Like many comedy writers, Al Jean honed his funny bone in college writing for the legendary Harvard Lampoon, where he met his writing partner, Mike Reiss. Upon graduating from Harvard, they worked for the National Lampoon magazine until they got a gig writing jokes for the movie Airplane 2, and they were suddenly bit by the Hollywood bug. They wrote for the groundbreaking news parody show, Not Necessarily the News, one of HBO's first forays into original programming. After that, he and Mike Reiss wrote for the short-lived but hilarious TV series Sledgehammer, which was one of my childhood favorites, and that's when they were brought on to The Tonight Show to write sketches and desk bits like Johnny Carson's famous Carnac routine, and in a more subtle way, to lend a younger, edgier humor to Carson, who wanted to stay relevant and keep up with the hot new guy on the late-night scene, David Letterman. Following a brief, awkward interview with Johnny himself, the head writer hired Al Jean and his partner Mike Reiss and told them not to get too comfortable because they'll probably be fired within 13 weeks. Writers were hired, fired, and rehired on The Tonight Show all the time back then. But Al and Mike managed to hang in there for 2 whole years before going on to write for the hit NBC sitcom ALF and then working as writers and producers on the groundbreaking It's Gary Shandling Show, the revolutionary single-camera comedy that would prove to be greatly influential on their next series, the most iconic and longest-lasting show of all time, The Simpsons. Today, I'll talk with Al about his early years on The Johnny Carson Show, including his favorite Carnac joke, writing those famous letters to Santa that were supposedly from little children, and putting on a talent show for Johnny. Then we'll get into the early days of The Simpsons and how many of the characters evolved from bad celebrity impressions by Hank Azaria. We'll discuss some of the early controversies that surrounded the show, including a strange rivalry between the fictional Simpsons family and the first President Bush. And I'll ask Al Jean if Rupert Murdoch has ever tried to censor some of the show's lighthearted jabs at Fox News. He'll talk about the process in The Simpsons writers' room and how they practically invented the VCR moment, packing every episode with more jokes than you could even catch in one viewing, and the challenge of keeping the show fresh after 625 episodes. We'll talk about the fans and some of their more interesting conspiracy theories that range from one that Homer has actually been in a coma since 1993 to claims that The Simpsons predicted 9/11 and even a Trump presidency. Plus, Al will reveal how he'd like to one day end the final episode. Not that they plan on ending the show anytime soon, he says. Coming up with Simpsons head writer and executive producer Al Jean in just a moment.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thrilled to be with Al Jean, the head writer and showrunner of The Simpsons, now entering its 28th season. Al Jean, thanks for sitting down with me.
My pleasure.
I'm having fun in your office while I was waiting, looking at all the Simpsons memorabilia. And I notice here you have a Japanese poster of a Don King fight.
It's
or something.
A Chinese poster.
Or Chinese, okay.
Given to me by Sam Simon, who used to manage a boxer named Lehman Brewster, who was the world heavyweight champ for a while. And Sam suggested calling this fight that was going to take place in Beijing the Great Brawl of China. But the Chinese promoters didn't want to call it that. So their title was Happy Get Together in Beijing. That's the name of the boxing match. Great name for a match.
Well, you're now entering the 28th season. That's 8 more seasons than the next longest running show.
Which is actually South Park now. Is it 20?
Oh, is it really? South Park is now 20? Okay, because I thought it was Gunsmoke.
Gunsmoke is also 20, but I'm sure South Park will pass them.
Okay, but Gunsmoke still has the highest number of episodes, right?
Not that we count, but 635.
Okay, yes. Are you going? I'm trying to think. Is this the season that you might surpass them, or is that the following season?
If we get a pickup for at least one more year, that would put us up to 647. So we would pass.
Okay. Okay. I have this image of you walking into the writer's room mid-season next season and just being like, we beat them, to hell with you all, I'm out of here, I'm going on vacation.
You know, it's funny,
I'm never coming back.
We joke about it. It's not like, I mean, to me, to get to 600 or 500, you know, is a real accomplishment. And it's such a different industry and a different, you know, template. Everything has its own luck that, you know, we're not competitive with them. We just, you know, want to do our own show. And of course, there's a huge advantage to being animated. You know, shows like Cheers were always great, and just the cast didn't want to do it at a certain point.
Yeah, you have this whole universe that you're working with of characters. No one ages. You don't have actors who age. You can do a million different settings. It's hard for me to imagine how they got 600-something plot lines out of Gunsmoke.
It is. And that, what's interesting about it is I did research it a little. They had a last episode, of course, and it wasn't any big deal. You know, it was the longest running show until that point or until this point. And they didn't have, you know, the 600th or 500th episode wasn't a milestone. It was just you just did television shows. You know, the first time I remember something being a milestone, I think, was maybe the 200th episode of Cheers. And the first last episode that was prominent was the last episode of The Fugitive and then the last episode of Mary Tyler Moore. And then it became a thing. And how do you end your series? And, you know, what they started, it wasn't at all, you know, there was no end to I Love Lucy.
Yeah. Well, you know, you came out, gosh, I guess when at the end of the 80s,
89 in December was the first Christmas show.
But you came out to Hollywood originally with Mike Reese, your writing partner. Y'all had been
in 1982. We were working on Airplane 2. That's the bad one of the airplane movies.
Yeah, that's the space shuttle one, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a good movie if you never saw Airplane 1. And that was our first writing job in L.A., and we worked for Not Necessarily the News on HBO, which was a great show. Sledgehammer, Alf.
Oh, I remember loving Sledgehammer. What happened to that show? Did that last very long?
Well, it was funny. It was
hilarious.
The first year, back when this was a huge thing, Miami Vice was on Friday nights, and they put it against Miami Vice, and Dallas, I think, was also against. So it had a terrible slot. And the second season, they put it against The Cosby Show, which was at its height. So, you know, it really didn't have much of a chance, but it was a really cool show.
And, it was a funny show.
Yeah, star David Rashi, really, really funny guy.
Yeah, and then you worked, I think, on The Tonight Show, right?
Previous to Sledgehammer, we were at The Tonight Show.
Okay.
From 84 to 86, when Carson was the host. And it was a great job to have had. I can't say I knew him well.
Yeah.
We saw him maybe 3 times the whole period we worked there. In person.
Yeah, what was the interview with Carson like?
This is already longer than the interview with Carson. Is that we were told, you know, just you know, don't say much, you know, he'll just kind of look you over. He made a joke about how young we were, and he was just like being a guest on his show, sort of. You know, you're sitting on a couch and talking to him for about 5 minutes, and he winked, and we said, it was a really pleasure to meet you, and we got the job, and never saw him again. pretty much.
Yeah, and what did someone say to you? They said, welcome to the show. You'll be gone in 13 weeks. Because he fired writers all the time and then rehired them.
They were rotated. I never knew, because you never talked to him directly, whether it was him or the head writer or why writers were rotating. But it was 13-week options, and we lasted a year and a half, which we thought, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's a good run.
And we were let go, but then they offered to have us come back, as they did, and then we were already working on Sledgehammer, so we couldn't.
Okay. And you didn't do the monologues, right?
No.
You guys wrote the sketches, the desk bits.
Yeah. Okay. Karnak, a little secret is Carson hated Karnak. He thought it was like a day off for the writers.
But that was everyone's favorite bit.
He never felt that way.
Really?
And then we worked on, Art Fern and the Tea Time movie and Floyd R. Turbo. And
all of the ripoff ones where he steals someone else's act.
It's correct. Those voices were, Art Fern was Jackie Gleason, Turbo was Tom Smothers.
Aunt Blabby, Jonathan Winters.
That was actually kind of a more bitter thing where he took the voice and Jonathan Winters was never on the show again, as I understood it. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's a little dark. And not only would the writers write the jokes, but they would write the savers for the jokes. And you guys, somewhere
along... To a degree. I mean, he was really funny and he didn't need anybody saving him from anything.
Okay.
But
when you would write ad-libs for him, right?
When you had Karnak, you would write savers like Karnak going down Cairo, Casa de Caca or something that he could, you were planning on it bombing. And then they called civilians, which was people who weren't in showbiz, were on the show, like a woman with a potato chip collection.
Right, I remember that.
Then you would write him lines in case it was a little tough, but... When it was a standard guest, like a Charles Grodin or something, you didn't write anything for him.
Yeah. And somewhere I heard that you guys actually wrote the letters from children to Santa Claus
that
one year.
That is true. Yeah. Every year they'd go. Johnny
those were
and the, on the air would
letters
go.
Letters from children written to Santa Claus. They were supposed to be
funny. They were
funny.
Supposed to be cute. And the New York Post Office would collect letters addressed to Santa. And Johnny on the show would always say, you can't make this up. And then one year the head writer said, the kids' letters suck. You got to make them up.
so
we did. We wrote the letters and the jokes about them, which was easier.
Did you have a favorite Karnak joke that you and Mike wrote?
We did, but it didn't air on The Tonight Show. It was Saint Elsewhere. What's the message on Mother Teresa's answering machine? Not real 80s joke, but it was... for some reason, Carson turned it down, and we did an ALF episode where ALF pretended he was the host of The Tonight Show, and we used it on that.
I remember that one. Okay, yeah, I think I remember that one.
Yeah, the ALF people were doing that episode and said, hey, you want to use your old material that never aired? And we said, that sounds like us.
Let me ask you, because I always heard that Johnny would make the staff perform in a talent show.
That is
once
correct.
A year for the anniversary party of the show.
There again,
he would
it was
force
like,
them to get up and entertain.
It was like you can't make this stuff up. Where there was a talent show, some people did it because they wanted to after the anniversary show. This was at the private party at the Beverly Hills Hotel. But then he would also one year he said to my writing partner Mike Reese and I, we had to perform. We didn't volunteer, so we did a little act and got some laughs. And then at the end, Carson said, "Don't quit your day job." After which, he fired us from our day job.
do you remember what the act was that you guys?
Yeah,
did?
I could play piano a little bit, so I played a thing from Pictures at an Exhibition. And Mike came out, it was kind of a stripper thing, but he was wearing a t-shirt and shorts. He had balloons all over him, and he smoked a cigar, which he used to pop the balloons. And then the t-shirt read, I Heart Johnny.
Like a Gypsy Rose Lee routine or
but
something.
But he was very funny doing it, and I was in a tux. And again, we were asked to do it. And again, he offered to hire us back. So you never really knew what was going on at that show. It was kind of like working for the Politburo or something. You had to read the wall posters to know who was up and who was down.
It was very compartmentalized because you guys were writing the sketches. The writers who wrote the monologues, you guys never even interacted, really. And you never really ran into Johnny.
Yeah, I would meet like Michael Berry once or twice at the party usually. There were two Mulholland's. There was Jim Mulholland, who I barely met, and there was Kevin Mulholland, who was also one of the sketch writers. Kevin is the one who came up with the Karnak Sis Boom Ba, what's the sound an exploding sheep makes, that people say is the best Karnak ever.
Yeah, and after you left Carson, what did you do between that and Simpson?
The technical thing was our option wasn't picked up.
Option wasn't picked up?
Yeah, we weren't.
But
we,
you were already there, what, two or three times longer than they predicted, huh?
Yeah,
when you walked in. Okay.
You know, it was famously difficult
to work there, I've heard, for writers. So.
You know, but it wasn't. What was difficult was that it was daily, and he... The truth of it is, he was a hilarious guy, and he was really, really funny just talking, and he always wanted to be, I think, somebody like Jackie Gleason, where he could do these great characters, but he really wasn't that. So he would do these things, and people would always say this to us. They go, why does he even do those bits that you write? Because, you know, to us, we like the monologue and Karnak and then go to the guests. And it's true. It was like we were sort of like caught in this little grindstone where it was like he wanted to do this thing, but he didn't really like it. And the truth is he didn't really even need to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, how did you end up on The Simpsons?
We ended up on The Simpsons because, as it happened a few times in our career, these writers we knew in college, Tom Gamble and Max Pross, were friends of Sam Simon, who was hiring writers for the show. He was developing it based on Matt Groening's cartoons and short Simpsons episodes.
From the Tracy Ullman show,
The Tracy Ullman show. And Sam wanted Tom and Max, but they were committed to a project of their own. So they recommended us, and we barely knew Sam, but we were the first staff writers hired. And it was by far the most fortuitous career thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah, I should say so. Now, what did you think of the show when you first came on it? Did you think it was going to go anywhere?
I thought two things. I thought I had loved Jim Brooks's work, you know, since Mary Tyler Moore Show, especially in Room 222. I mean, he was the greatest TV writer then and now. And Sam worked with him on Taxi, which was another one of my favorite shows. And I liked Matt's work very much, Life and Hell and the L.A. Reader first and then The Weekly. So I thought, well, with these three guys, an opportunity to work with them is great. I thought, I don't know, who knows if this will be a hit, but it's animated and there's nothing animated that's been on in years. And it's going to be from this quality trio, so it's going to get noticed. And then when I saw the Christmas episode put together, the first episode that aired and we had worked on it, I thought to myself, oh my God, this is the best thing I've ever been involved with. This is really, you know, gonna, and I knew it was a hit. I went to Disney World and they had a Simpsons jacket and people were coming up and asking about it. And, you know, you thought, oh my gosh, it's, you know, this is.
It was a phenomenon.
It was from day one. Yeah, I mean, you know, I wish everyone in their life would have at least one thing like we had that at the beginning there, where it was just unbelievably popular. I would literally walk down the street and you'd hear people talking about it. And my fear at the time, when we started to run it in season three, was, as I said, we'd worked on ALF, and ALF was a top 10 show in season two when I was there full time. By the end of season four, it was off the air, and Mork and Mindy had a similar arc, and shows that had an audience that was, you know, a lot of kids in it, would often be meteoric in their ascent and descent, and I was really nervous that The Simpsons would be a similar fast fate, so we just, you know, seasons three and four, and everybody who's worked on it then and since has just been, you know, so concerned with keeping it good and popular.
Yeah, and I think you've done a fantastic job keeping this fresh over the years. And it is funny because, like, yeah, kids can be so fickle. But I remember I was a kid when it first came out. I mean, I can remember the day after the first episode, me and all my buddies talking about The Simpsons the next day at school. And I guess one of the reasons it's lasted, at least with my generation, is because we've kind of grown up with the show. It started being all about Bart, and then we all get older and fatter, and we evolve into Homer. And I feel like I've kind of gone through it with the show.
Well, what's bizarre, and by the way, I can relate. When I was a kid, the Batman TV series came on, and I remember that being the biggest deal in the world the day after it aired, and talking about it in kindergarten. But now what's happened is that it's been on and been part of so many people's lives that these crazy, like the choose me Valentine. I got that Valentine when I was in third grade. It's a real thing.
The Ralph Wiggum one.
Yeah. And I pitched that idea for that story. And now it's arguably the most famous Valentine in the history of Valentines. And, you know, there are similar things that, you know, Matt certainly, like, you know, the characters named after his family.
Yeah.
I think he always thought the show was going to be a hit, but I think he, you know, no one could have dreamed how famous the name Homer Simpson would become. And Homer Groening is his father, and Homer Groening is a very smart man and not a Homer Simpson at all. And
what I think of is I remember, what was it, Day of the Locusts?
The movie character in the book was named Homer Simpson.
His name Homer Simpson. I can't watch that now without laughing, because it's a serious movie.
Well, Matt was extremely clever. Movie. There were so many allusions and references to Portland streets, to, you know, things that he knew. The M and the G are in Homer's hair. You know, I mean, it's real, you know, very cleverly
insider-y.
Layered. Yeah, there's many levels to it.
And I remember it's so strange to look back at those early episodes now, because Homer, he was doing like a Walter Matthau impression. It was like, come here, boy.
He was doing Walter Matthau. He was also angrier than stupid. He was actually kind of a mad.
He's kind of an ogre.
Yeah. And, you know, he's getting stupider and smarter at various points, and we try not to make him too stupid. But, you know, it internalized to a character. Dan Castellaneta made it into something that was its own and wasn't just Walter Matthau or angry, cranky guy. And that's what great characters, you know, are. They have roots, but then they become their own. They take on their own life.
Yeah, and it seems like so many of the characters on the show are just Hank Azaria or someone doing a bad impression of some Hollywood star. You know, Wiggum is Edward G. Robinson. The professor is Jerry Lewis.
He said Mo was Al Pacino.
Yeah,
a very strained, you know, Al Pacino. But again, Mo is totally unique, you know, great character that Hank has evolved him into.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back for more with The Simpsons' Al Jean when we come back in just a minute. Hey folks, do you like reading but find it's getting harder and harder to make time to curl up with a good book? Well, there's a solution. Give audiobooks a try. They're perfect for your commute to work or working out at the gym, a relaxing bath, or any time, really. And right now, you can take an audiobook for a spin with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews. to get a free 30-day trial and download any of Audible's 180,000 titles entirely for free. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. Yeah, I can remember in those early days all the controversy around the show. You know, what was it? Wasn't there a controversy with Bush?
The first Bush, everyone was criticizing it.
Yeah.
The first Bush, who's a Democrat now today, voting for Hillary.
Yeah, Bush 41, yeah.
This is what I always thought. He's a smart guy, and he's got a sense of humor. He did a line at a convention saying, America should be more like the Waltons than the Simpsons. I doubt he had seen the Simpsons, and I think somebody said, oh, this will get a big applause line from the right-wing crowd.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we had to do a response. So we just said, well, we're like the Waltons. We're praying for an end to a depression, too.
And I think Barbara criticized you. And wasn't there something with C. Everett Koop where he was visiting a sick kid and there was a poster of Bart?
Oh, I don't know about the Koop one.
Maybe it was someone else like that. Someone in the administration. I thought it was C. Everett Koop for some
reason. Because he was Reagan. I thought he was
earlier. Oh, okay.
But I don't.
Okay, yeah. I'm not
Barbara
sure who
Bush
it was.
Criticized this.
Yeah.
And then we wrote, Jim Brooks wrote a letter as Marge to Barbara saying, you know, we're just mothers, like you and I, trying to, you know, raise our families. And then Barbara Bush wrote a gracious response to that. And then I think the first Bush finally watched it when the episode aired where Homer was his neighbor, and his response
one of my favorites.
It's the stupidest thing I've ever seen.
So, oh, he said that?
And then our response is, well, take a look at your son.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It could go on forever. I actually, the Bush 41, there's a lot I admire about him. I, you know, what happened subsequently, I think, is sad. But
yeah, yeah. And that episode is one of the silliest episodes and funniest episodes, is where, I'm sure people know it, where Bush, I guess Bush, once he's out of
once
the White
retired.
House, he retires and moves across the street, and he has this rivalry with Homer Simpson. And the best thing is the button at the end when Homer finally drives him crazy and he leaves the neighborhood in a huff. Next thing you know, Gerald Ford moves in, and Homer and Gerald Ford end up being best buddies.
Yes. Well, it was another, you know, it's funny. I think about, I couldn't vote when Ford ran, but I liked Ford and I would have voted for him. And, you know, how the media has these narratives where the narrative with him was he was stupid and clumsy. And I go, he's neither of those things. He went to Yale Law School and he was a football player. And it's just funny how you get these perceptions, these comic perceptions, and they're not true at all.
Yeah. Now, at a certain point, I guess you guys were showrunners on it pretty early on. And
season
then,
3 and 4.
Yeah.
And then Jim Brooks wanted us to do The Critic. Wanted us to create our own animated show.
Oh, okay.
Show.
So that was his idea. That wasn't you guys.
I never want to leave.
You didn't want to leave Simpsons.
No, kicking and
screaming. Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, we stayed as consultants. And then we went to Disney because they're already showrunners in place. And at Disney, we had a deal that allowed us to produce our own Simpsons, which included the X-Files crossover and the Lisa Sachs episode. And then after the Disney deal expired, Mike Scully was running it, and I was offered a chance to return. And I said, absolutely, and I haven't left.
What didn't work with The Critic? I mean, now it's gotten kind of a cult following, but it only lasted a season.
Well, the biggest problem was it was on the wrong network initially. It was on ABC because that was a network Jim Brooks had to deal with. And we wrote it like The Simpsons, but it was put after Home Improvement, a huge hit. And, you know, I'm not blaming anyone but ourselves. We didn't carry the lead in of that show. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't hold on to it. What's really funny is if you look at the actual numbers we got, they would be huge hits. Like we got 8.6s or something. And then it was moved to Fox, and it actually was a success on Fox after The Simpsons. Ratings wise, it was doing fine, and it was canceled because the person that bought it then wasn't president of the network. And you know, usually that often means that their projects get taken off the air. So that was so it didn't work, and then it did, but that. It's a very common story in a lot of
I feel like I had the same problem with The Critic that I have with Family Guy, in that unlike The Simpsons, it stops everything for a gag.
Well,
in the middle of
a story,
I wish
we
had
the problem,
you know?
Of Family Guy's longevity and success.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly.
The biggest thing with The Critic, we did testing and it was very eye-opening because what it was we made the character kind of pathetic and whiny, and I, you know, John Lovitz is really funny, and what we didn't capture about John is that he has this great confidence that's often based on nothing. and once in the second season, when it seemed to work after The Simpsons on Fox, he was a confident guy, he had a girlfriend, you know, he was still like annoyed by the world and lived in New York and all that, but he was not miserable, and that's always a good lesson.
Now, when you came back to The Simpsons, was that a happy moment for you, I assume?
Oh, I was so happy. I remember it was July 1st, 1998, and I came in, and I was like, I missed this so much. the best thing about it, or one of the best things, was when you're out, you know, trying to do your own show, you get all these notes from the network, you get like, dozens of executives telling you what to do, and they conflict with each other, and nobody really
knows.
Yeah, whereas with The Simpsons, it makes money, people know what's good about it, and you don't have to justify it. You can just do what you think is good.
You've never gotten a call from Rupert?
No,
never
did.
A complaint?
No, and we've really lacerated Fox News. We did do we had a thing where we had a helicopter that said Fox News, not racist, but number one with racists. And then we did two more. There was like a controversy, and Bill O'Reilly, knocked us. So we did two more Fox helicopters. And then somebody said, okay, you did three. You can stop for a while. So that was, I would call that good sport, not bad.
Okay, but you never got a call from Rupert.
Nope.
Okay.
No. Okay.
You had him on the show, right?
Yeah.
Was that his voice?
Yeah, multiple times playing an evil billionaire. Yeah.
Now, when you're working in the writer's room on The Simpsons, what is the process like when you're writing an episode? How does it begin?
Well, the writer or team of writers, a pair of writers, comes up with an idea for an episode, and we have a retreat every year. Matt and Jim and I, listen to the stories, and the ones that are promising, we turn into full-fledged, beginning, middle, and ends, maybe a B story. And the writer goes off and does a first draft. And then it's completely rewritten about a dozen times by the writing staff. Every script, mine or anybody else's, just gets, put through this process, which I think makes it much, much better. We read it at the table with the cast, and we see what works and what doesn't, and we get their input. We revise it and record it on the following Monday. The reads are on Thursday. It goes to the animators who do storyboards, which are now on an iPad, so that you can actually kind of see them animated, which has really helped the process, and you rewrite those. This is like the one change in the last, 5 years that makes us, even sort of more streamlined than we've been, would be in the years prior. Then we have an animatic, which is a rough screening with the writers. We rewrite that. We have a color screening. We just had one today for a show that'll air in December, and you can still make some changes. It's a lot harder in the color. It's a lot more expensive to change, so you do minimal changes then. But you could really, my joke is always, we did a show about the Soviet Union, joke in at the show, that by the time it aired, we had to change the joke because the Soviet Union had broken up.
Yeah, I mean, for a writer, it must be a torturous process. If you write a gag or a joke that works in the room, then you have to wait for the actors to record it so you can hear it. Then you have to wait, a month or so for the animators to actually...
But there's usually... We do things that are pretty timeless. Like, we do have a show coming out where Castro's alive. So it was like, hold on one more month. Yeah. But, I think it makes it better because the thing about it is that you get perspective. You get a couple months where you haven't worked on it, and you come back and you work on the show again, and you can see what works and what doesn't. And that is invaluable.
Yeah, and when you plan out a season... it's not like an ordinary show where you have an arc to the season. Do you just start banging out ideas, or do you say, okay, we need so many spoof episodes, we need a Burns episode?
No, there's no quotas. Okay. And we don't do arcs. There's a couple reasons. We didn't at the beginning, it was the main reason, but the other reasons I would say are, I love shows that have arcs. Some of my favorite shows ever are like Mad Men and The Sopranos, but for us... I think that there's a great quality that it's interchangeable, that the show from season 2 to season 22 is kind of the same. And, my ending for the series, if we should ever end, would be that we go back at the very end of the Christmas pageant that opened the series, and it's all a loop, that there's no ending and no beginning. And
because if they never age, you could do that.
Yeah, I think the one reason we've lasted so long is because we don't have, shows with arcs. Some of them don't syndicate as well because people know what happens at the end, and they're like, "Well, I know that story." And we like to just have the ability to shift shows and not like we don't say this is going to happen, then that's going to happen. And I don't, some have been forced upon us, sadly, by like Marsha Wallace passing away. But
yeah, and it must be. I mean, it's great that any one episode can stand on its own. You can you can jump into the show any point that you want.
And I feel like, whatever I do, whoever took over, they still have the same basic template, and they could do whatever they wanted, and I haven't, altered it irrevocably for them.
Yeah, but after 28 seasons, it must be really hard for you guys to come up with new storylines.
That's the hardest part of the job.
Not repeat yourself, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's hard, and... but that's why, it's a good job. It means because people, sit and think and make it better.
Yeah.
And it's about a family, and everywhere in the world people have families, and the families have problems that they didn't 30 years ago, so it's always something.
How do you keep from repeating gags? I mean, do you have a database that you check?
It's just when our memories, writing an episode? Mine and Matt Selman and yeah. the writers. And we have. I mean, there have been repeated things, but I'm always embarrassed. It's not too many, fortunately.
Yeah, yeah, none that I've noticed. You have so many of these text gags that are put into the show, not just from the chalkboard scenes, but the Any Marquee and so forth. And I guess you guys really created the VCR joke or the VCR moment.
We certainly took advantage of it. We knew that there would be things you couldn't possibly see and that you could, you know, when we began, VCRs were definitely omnipresent and now TiVo and anything else. So that was our goal was to, you know, and it's advanced so much. I mean, shows, again, like Mad Men have so many layers to them and things that you really have to watch twice at least before you understand what's going on.
Some of those text jokes kind of, I guess, get lost because people don't even pay attention sometimes. Unless you're a hardcore fan, you stop and you read those. Do you ever feel like you waste a lot of good material there?
No, no. I mean, if it's there and somebody can possibly get it, it's worth it.
Yeah. Now, what are the fans like
when you run into them? The ones I've met and the ones that I hear from on Twitter.
Are they crazy?
No, they're great. I mean, again, one of the best aspects of the job is that people will say, honestly, I've had this said to me that you know, during a tough time in somebody's life, that The Simpsons helped them get through it. And I go, really? Wow, that's wonderful.
Are you amazed by some of the minutia that they throw at you?
Yeah, they remember the more than I do, and they know more. And but again, I remember when I was a kid and how much, you know, people loved Sherlock Holmes. And I thought, you know, wow, I mean, that's the mark of something that's good is that people really care about it.
Yeah, and they care so much that these conspiracies seem to pop up. I was interested to read, I guess there are conspiracy theories that Homer's been in a coma since 1993 and that Homer is secretly Krusty the Clown.
Two different things. The coma, you know, that it would mean that everything that we planned something that we didn't tell anybody and that every showrunner since, you know, adhered to it. That isn't true and never was. The Krusty thing, it is true that when Matt designed Krusty, he put Homer's design in a clown suit on top of it. And originally, again, he had a lot of little ideas that, you know, he was planning. One was that Krusty would turn out to be Homer, like a secret identity. But he's not. I mean, you know, now just the designs look alike.
Yeah, and wasn't one of his other plans that at the final episode, Marge was going to turn out to be a rabbit? He's going to have a reveal where she takes off her hair.
But yeah, I mean, obviously he thought that wasn't, you know, in line with the character anymore.
Yeah, and some of these are actually serious conspiracy theories. There are these theories that you guys have somehow predicted 9/11 and the Ebola scare, and you and Matt Groening are in the Illuminati or something.
it's different things. There's an insane, terrible coincidence. There was a Homer Goes to New York episode written by Ian Maxtone Graham where there was a pamphlet that said New York on $9 a day, and behind the nine were the Twin Towers that looked like an 11, so it looked like a 9/11, and that aired in 98. Oh. It was an absolute bizarre, terrible coincidence. The Ebola thing was a show I wrote, but what people forget is there was a movie that Dustin Hoffman was in about
Two
Ebola.
Two movies, in fact, I think,
so
weren't
it
there
wasn't,
at
it
the
wasn't
same
something
time.
That it was, like, never heard of. So that was where that came from. Then there were things, though. We did, you know, have a joke about Trump being president. And did a World Cup show where it was in Brazil, and we thought that it'd be funny if the Brazilians lost. So we thought, well, who would win? Probably Germany. So we did predict that final, you know, correctly. So maybe we are. I don't know.
Yeah, there are these theories that you guys are either, I guess, omniscient or part of the New World Order or something. So
I think if you say enough things, then some of them will come true.
Yeah, and some of these are so hilarious because one was, you know, there's an episode where I guess the citizens of Shelbyville steal the lemon tree in Springfield. And then they point to, like, 15 years later, someone stole a lemon tree in Houston, Texas. See?
Yes. It's stuff that
wild predictions. They're like Nostradamus over there. You know, one of the fun things that I enjoy is when I go overseas, different versions that you get when you're in Germany or Japan or France and hear the different voices.
Yeah, they're great. And they have terrific actors and actresses playing them. And I cast voices for the Simpsons movie, and what I found was the hardest to cast by far was Marge,
Really?
To get that combination of warmth and humor. It was really, you know, there were Homers that they didn't sound like ours, but they were really funny. You could tell the guy was funny, like if you would record the actor doing the falling down the cliff scene. But Myers was tricky.
Yeah, and isn't it in France, I think the French Homer and the French Marge are married or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, that's really sweet.
The voices. Yeah, and what does Homer say in Germany? He doesn't say dough.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, okay. Somewhere I read that. I think he says nine or something like that.
Wherever you go in the world and you work on The Simpsons, people are happy to talk about it with you.
Well, you said that you could probably do this the rest of your life. I think you said that pretty early on in the beginning. When
and
you first
I never
came
dreamed
on the show.
It would really be
talk
a possibility.
About omniscient.
Yes.
There you
well,
go.
There was a film I just saw of me in season three saying it could run 20 years. So I, you know, but now who knew? I didn't.
Yeah. And, you know, what happened? Because I remember it seems like about maybe 5-10 years ago, the movie came out and they
almost,
were saying we were going to do 2 more seasons and that's it. And then we'll do maybe a movie or two. And then I remember dreading that moment. And then, I don't know, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years go by. And I'm like, well, whatever happened to that? I guess
they're
still going.
The movie, one reason we did it was to, you know, help the show, you know, become re-energized and you know, make The Simpsons a huge deal, you know, worldwide. And it was a really big moment. And you know, it was never... No one that I know of is planning on ending it or planning how to end it. I mean, it you know, I'm not saying it won't end. Everything ends, but there's no plan.
Yeah. Now, do you think you might die on The Simpsons? You might die working on The Simpsons, I mean.
I believe I will die someday. Yeah, you know, I'm no Nostradamus there. But
these tech billionaires, they're working on extending longevity, you know.
All right.
Yeah, Elon Musk and those guys. So, yeah, you never know. Yeah, you could be slaving away for Fox forever, but there are worse things in life.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, do you have a favorite character before we go?
I love writing for Lisa because when I was a kid, I was more like the kid that would read. My sister was more like Bart. She was more, you know, like unruly, and she would say "rub-a-dub," thanks for the grub, for the, when she was asked to say
"Oh, that's from your family, that line?"
That was my sister. And I like comic book guy, you know, I loved comic books and, you know, he's a voice for all of us.
Yeah. Where did the voice from comic book guy come from?
I will tell you, he's a roommate or college dorm mate of Hank Azaria's. And he would say if something bothered him, "You're on my list." And I guess Hank is really on his list now after making fun of him for 25 years.
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, I'm such a fan. I've watched for 27 years now since I was a kid. I find myself, I mean, I'll have entire evenings where I have conversations with people just over The Simpsons and Simpsons references. It's everywhere in the culture. At one point, I feel like I have to go back and watch every episode because in life, every now and then, I'll miss some type of reference. I feel that if I watched every episode and took notes, I would pretty much be the wittiest guy in the room anywhere I go. So, well, the season premiere is on Sunday. Al Jean, I hope that you guys keep on going for another 28 years.
Both the show and myself.
Yes,
thank you.
Exactly. Thanks so much for talking to me.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thanks again to Al Jean for coming on the show. What a sweet and funny guy he is. And whatever you do, don't miss the season 28 premiere of The Simpsons this Sunday, September 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern on Fox. You can follow Al on Twitter at Al Jean, that's A-L-J-E-A-N. And you can even follow The Simpsons themselves on Twitter at The Simpsons. And for other cool stuff, visit the Ultimate Simpsons fan site at SimpsonsWorld.com. There's clips, trivia, they have character bios, there's cool insider stuff from the creators, including Al Jean. And if that doesn't satisfy your Simpsons addiction, you can watch The Simpsons reruns 5 nights a week on FXX. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. Or if you prefer, you can set up a recurring monthly contribution at Patreon.com/kickassnews.
You can visit Kickass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at KA Politics. And please be sure to recommend Kickass News to all your friends on your social media. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnewspodcast.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.